This is the Friday edition of the Large Morning Show in the afternoon on the Big 550 KTRS. I am Paul Harris. Ian and Dan are here with me. And Chris Impey is joining us now. Chris is a professor of astronomy at the University of Arizona, the head of the astronomy department, which, by the way, is the largest astronomy department at any university in America. And he's written a fascinating new book called Beyond, Our Future in Space. Chris, welcome to the Big 550.
I'm pleased to talk to you, Paul.
Nice to have you on here. I'm a lifelong space interest guy because I grew up in the 60s in the heart of the space race to put men not only into space but eventually put us on the moon. And so when I saw the phrase in the subtitle of your book, Our Future in Space, it reminded me of books that I read when I was like 8 years old, which showed rockets going through space and taking people and we're living on other planets and all that sort of stuff. Some of it has happened. Some of it has not. Here's my first question for you. Take an 8-year-old boy today and tell him a couple of things that will be in his future in space.
I would say with fair degree of certainty for an 8-year-old today that they will have the chance to recreate in space, which is to say, without spending a fortune, you know, go into zero gravity, see what that is like. And maybe if they're really committed, they have the chance to set foot on another world or travel well beyond the Earth.
So are you talking about space tourism?
I'm talking about space tourism for the most part, but also just a much larger set of people, you know, doing science, doing commerce, doing mining, doing all sorts of activities out in space.
Now, you mentioned living on, or at least touching foot on, other planets and other places in space, including the moon and beyond. How realistic is that, and how soon are we talking about? Not just for an 8-year-old boy, but I'm a middle-aged guy. Will I see that in my lifetime?
It's going to be, in our lifetimes, it's going to be expensive. It's just going to take a few decades to mature. We're just seeing the birth pangs of the space industry, the private space industry, you know, with a bad mishap for SpaceX just a few days ago. So we know it's hard.
Yeah.
And there will be problems and disasters and, you know, worse, some people will die. So, it's going to take a couple of decades before it matures to that point. But, you know, there's a lot of people, there's a lot of smart money in the game. There's a lot of different players, way more than there used to be when it was just us against the Russians trying to get to the moon. So
yeah.
I do think it's going to happen.
I think having Elon Musk on the side of a future in space is a good thing.
Yeah, he's an unusual person because he has, you know, he's obviously a great businessman, but he has a lot of technical savvy, too. So he covers both sides. And that's very unusual.
Now, what about this guy, Boz Landorp, who is trying to put together the Mars One mission? I actually talked to him about a year and a half ago, and we've also talked to one of the people who wants to go on this mission, a woman here in St. Louis, who wants to be part of this one-way mission to Mars. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, obviously it's cheaper to go one way. And in fact, NASA, they sort of got outed on having a one-way plan for Mars for NASA astronauts. You know, that put people back a bit, but I think the Mars One is a little not flaky, but it's very challenging. A lot of engineers just don't necessarily consider they have the technical savvy to pull off what they want to do.
Yeah.
And then the financing model based on reality TV show, you know, you raise your eyebrows and probably legitimately. So I'm not sure they'll do it. There are people, for instance, we didn't mention Jeff Bezos. He's Blue Origins, obviously Mr. Amazon, and he's got a huge amount of money, and he's investing at the level that Elon Musk is, and we just don't know much about what he's doing. He's very secretive about it. So there's some other interesting people who have a real track record as entrepreneurs.
Is the biggest problem in going to Mars the distance?
Yes, the distance and the danger. You know, you're in the vacuum of space with cosmic rays. You're going to take a lifetime's worth of radiation dose just getting there and back. Mm. Forget about on the surface. So, you know, the moon is a lot easier, of course. You know, it's hundreds of times closer, and so it may not seem as exotic or exciting, but that's probably where we'll learn how to live off the planet.
Do you think, you know, as I said, I was a kid of the 60s, and the space race and getting us towards that July night in 1969 when Armstrong and Aldrin put their boot prints on the lunar surface, still, to me, the greatest accomplishment in human history. But I'm saddened by the fact that we've not gone back since 1972. Do you think that if the United States, with the cooperation of other countries, were to do that again, that the public would get behind it?
I think they would, especially if they saw a range of people going. And one of the issues of NASA for many decades was that the astronauts are sort of a monoculture. I mean, they're mostly from Ohio, as it turned out. But there were, you know, a lot of, you know, extremely brave and competent test pilots, and they weren't like us, you know. So it got hard for people to relate to the astronauts when they really came from one culture. In the next phase, I think it'll be a lot more varied, and then it'll be a lot easier for people to imagine in that situation. And also, it was an anomaly, the way we got to the moon. It was incredible, as you said, and it's kind of disconcerting to realize that most Americans weren't alive when it happened, and so it's like a dim cultural memory.
Yeah.
And of course, we know some people even deny that it actually happened.
Ugh.
So the next phase will hopefully engage and involve a lot more people and a lot more range of people, so that, you know, we send artists and poets and philosophers and business people and so on, and then, you know, everyone will get to share what it's like rather than just having this one small group of people.
All right, I want to ask you about a couple of specific things from your book, Beyond Our Future in Space, Chris, and one of them is a space elevator.
Mm-hmm.
What is that, and what would it do?
It sounds crazy, in a sense. It's a science fiction concept, and Arthur C. Clarke was asked, you know, when will we get a space elevator? And he said, 50 years after everyone stops laughing. And he was only partially joking. It's a cable that you play out into space, almost like an Indian rope trick, because there's nothing around it. And if you can get it high enough to be at the geostationary point, which is the place where a satellite would just sit above the Earth, because it's orbiting the Earth at the same rate that the Earth is spinning, then the cable is literally held in the air, suspended into space by centrifugal force, by the spinning of the Earth itself, balancing the weight of the cable.
So wait, let me just stop you for a second. Are we talking about something that's like a cable that's connected to something on Earth and goes up out of our atmosphere and into space?
No, it doesn't even have to be tethered. I mean, you would just have to play it. You do have to support it in the phase where you're playing it up off the Earth's surface. But when you get it to a high enough place, then it starts to be held in tension, you know, so that it supports itself by the spinning of the Earth. And so it doesn't actually need to be held. It can be tethered and stabilized, but it doesn't need to be supported. It's self-supporting. Now, we can't do it on the Earth. The technology simply doesn't exist. We don't have the materials. It's too hard. It's too big a cable. It needs to be too strong. But on the moon, we could do that. And so it becomes another reason why the moon is more attractive as a first place to go for an economic venture, because once you have a space elevator off the moon's surface, you can essentially get stuff into the solar system almost for free, because you're not using rocket fuel or rockets.
Okay, let's step back for just a second. I can understand how you can do something more easily on the moon than on Earth, because it's 1/6 of the gravity. But there's no atmosphere there, so you probably don't need to go as high to get outside of an atmosphere. So then once you put this cable up, sticking up out of the moon like a giant antenna, what are we doing with it? I mean, a cable can't launch a rocket.
No, but you can move stuff in elevator cars up and assemble it in zero gravity, essentially. So building big, cumbersome, and what would on Earth be very heavy stuff in zero gravity is much easier. You know, we've seen astronauts sort of moving these crazily huge things and heavy things in zero gravity. So the moon just becomes your staging post. It's your place where you start your economic activity, where you build your spaceships and your ore carriers when you're mining asteroids, and your ships to carry people around the solar system. And remember, the lunar soil, while it appears pretty dull and inert, you can get water and oxygen out of the lunar soil with quite simple technology. So once you have a moon base, you can get oxygen to make rocket fuel or breathe it. You can get water to support yourself, and so you don't have to bring all this stuff from the Earth. So it is a much cheaper place. You know, if you can build an infrastructure there, it becomes a much cheaper place.
And then we use that space elevator to launch what to where?
We use the space elevator to build up in orbit, but build our spaceships, basically, to travel around the solar system, because you're no longer fighting gravity. You're constructing them in moon orbit, having elevated the materials essentially for free with this elevator. And so that becomes a much easier place to build things and then send them around the solar system.
All right, what's the timeline on this?
You know, the technology exists to do it now, and the cost estimates I've read range from $5 to $10 billion, which is a lot of money, but it's about a tenth of what the space station has cost. So So, you know, the money is not the showstopper. I mean, it's a critical mass of people willing to do it probably is as an economic venture. So I'm thinking 15 years.
15 years from now. Wow. Now, one of the other things you write about in the book, which I'm also fascinated by, and anybody who's ever watched any science fiction movie that involved long-haul space travel, whether it was 2001 in 1969 or Interstellar last year, it included putting the crew into hypersleep. Essentially, you're going to hibernate while the robot spaceship takes you where you need to go, and then you'll be awakened by Hal, the evil computer who will kill you. Now, Now, how we can't hibernate people now, right?
No, we can't, but the technology to take people into a down state, if you like, is getting a lot better. So it's really motivated by resuscitation after near brain death.
Well, that's the important part of it, Chris. We can put anybody down we want. It's the bringing them back up that's the hard part.
That's right, but that's what's moving quite fast. So people are using dogs and pigs, which are the closest mammal analogs to us. We can't really do it on people. It's too dangerous and unethical. And they have had experiments where essentially you replace your body fluid by a sort of glycol-type compound that works well enough instead of blood. And then you can be chilled to a point where your metabolism goes to 1% or less of the normal rate. And dogs and pigs, for example, have been resuscitated from being essentially in this chilled weight state after hours or days. Success rate, of course, not 100%. Some of them die, but some of them are totally fine. So with mammals, we think we're developing the techniques to chill, essentially produce a chilled, suspended animation state that could work to get people around the solar system.
I'm glad you said resuscitate, not reanimate, because that makes you seem like some evil genius living in a mountain somewhere.
Right. Well, we still have to worry about Hal, as you pointed out. The computer that's going to control all of this has to be trustworthy.
Yeah. And speaking of that, computers and technology, why do we even have to go at all? I mean, right now, you can play a video game and pretend that you're an avatar that's on the screen, and you're inside that person, and you know, with these virtual reality helmets, you can actually be inside a character that's in a video game. Can't we send robots and see and feel everything that they do while they go to this dangerous distance in space?
You're absolutely right. We can. And in fact, in the space science community, there's a pretty big argument about this, where planetary scientists will know they can get so much more bang from their buck by sending spacecraft and robots rather than people to Mars and Titan and Europa and all these cool places. So I think we could do it all with robots. It's completely possible, and it's cheaper, and it's more reliable, and nobody gets hurt.
Yeah.
But for engaging humans, and also there is some part of the human, in the beginning of my book I write about the so-called explorer gene, this fact that it's built in us to explore, even if we don't need to for food or shelter. So I think there's always going to be a set of people. Elon Musk has famously said he wants to die on Mars. There's a set of people that are going to do it because they want to go. They want to explore. They want to see what it feels like to be off the Earth. Remember, we've only had those 12 Apollo astronauts who stood on another world. 12 people in the history of 7 billion on this planet. It's a pretty rare club.
Yeah. If it's okay with you, I'm going to let Elon go and I'll Skype with him.
Yeah, that's fine. I don't want to be in the first wave either. It's definitely going to be hazardous though, for the first decade or so.
Now, while we're talking about hazards, my friend Phil Plate, who has been on this show many, many times, has written about things in the sky that can kill us. And one of those, of course, is asteroids. And about once a year, I see a news story, not much more often than that, I see a news story about how some asteroid is coming within 250,000 miles of Earth. It's the closest we've had one in 25 years or whatever it is. And, you know, people who don't understand math and science start freaking out. An asteroid is coming, etc. But at some point, there is going to be something that's revolving around our solar system that's going to bump into us, and it's not going to go any better for us than it did for the dinosaurs. And so why don't we work on a plan to make that not happen?
I think we actually have that plan. You're right that this news story seemed to be increasing in frequency, but that's partly because our senses and our monitoring of potential Earth-hitting junk is much better. So we know the stuff that's out there. And because we know the stuff that's out there, and the telescopes doing this are pretty sensitive, if it's a dinosaur-killing-sized asteroid, we're going to see it not when it's, you know, screaming towards us and the clock is ticking down like in a movie. We're going to see it probably a couple of years from the time it might hit the Earth, and it'll still just be a mite at that point. And that's actually long enough to do something about it. So it won't be the doomsday scenario with the clock ticking and we got almost no time to play with. We'll have a couple of years. And the, you know, the non-Doctor Strangelove thing, the Doctor Strangelove thing is you blow it to smithereens, but of course the smithereens keep going in the same direction and they all hit you.
Yeah.
So that's not a good idea.
Smithereens can really hurt.
Yeah, you don't do the Doctor Strangelove thing. The smart thing is you send out as massive a spacecraft as you can muster, and as fast as you can muster, and you travel alongside it and use it as what's called a gravity tractor. So if you've got that kind of lead time of a couple of years, you basically just send a spacecraft to track it and just gradually tug it away from the trajectory that's going to hit the Earth. And
wow.
It's a very harmless way of doing it. Of course, you have to trust those rocket scientists to do the calculation right, that it wasn't just going to miss and they've just tugged it to so that it's going to hit. And you do have to trust people on this one.
Yes, you do.
I have a question for talking about all of that. Does the movie Deep Impact and Armageddon, which are basically the same movie with different actors, mm-hmm. is that stuff possible where they can send a ship up and actually land on one of those?
We landed on a comet. The European Space Agency did that.
Absolutely. We can. That's the new, you know, degree of difficulty in the space program that we're challenged to and able to land on some of these small bodies. So, for instance, with the Earth trajectory asteroid, we could land on it too, or we could land on it and attach rockets to it and deflect it into a different trajectory.
Hey, how about if we land on it and hook it up to the space elevator, and everybody gets to go up and take a look?
Hey,
yeah, that, or you could just turn it into an Earth orbiting object to give everyone a nice show. You know, few hours you get to see it whizzing by like a big thing in the sky.
The possibilities are endless, as is space. It's a great book. It's called Beyond Our Future in Space. Professor Chris Impey is the head of the astronomy department at the University of Arizona. I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It was fun talking to you.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.